The title of the lesson this morning is Blaming Others. So this is something we ought to be able to relate to in a very practical way. Because blaming others for our mistakes or problems is a basic component of human nature. It's a common form of excuse making. It's done to lessen our responsibility or to justify us for what we might have done wrong. We think that it relieves us of the condemnation that we ought to be receiving for our wrongdoings and the penalty or punishment or consequences or problems which result from those wrongdoings. And all of this is achieved by shifting the onus or responsibility or burden of responsibility either partially or completely to other people. As I said in the beginning, isn't this something we can all relate to? Haven't we all engaged in blaming others? Blaming others is so easy to do, and it's so powerful as a mechanism of self-defense or self-preservation that virtually every person does it. I certainly have, and I imagine you could say the same for yourself, because the self-preservation instinct naturally makes us want to look at others as the cause of our problems. And there are plenty of people around who could conceivably be the cause of our problems. That's because human beings want to interact with one another and do frequently interact with one another. So there is this web of social interaction such that that interaction with other people ensures that there's going to be no shortage of people who can be made to share responsibility for our problems or our adversity. And you just think about it. We can put blame for our problems on just quite a variety of people because it is the case that others often share in the problems that we experience. So experience in life has shown us that blaming others can be very successful. And it is so effective simply because it is often, if not usually, something that contains an element of truth in it. I mean, you just think about it for a moment. We have to pay perhaps more than we did a year or two ago for gasoline in our vehicles. And we can get pretty aggravated about that. And we can start blaming other people for that, just a variety of other people. We can say, well, President Putin of Russia is to blame for this because he invaded Ukraine and that's caused gas prices to go up in one way or another. You could say, President Biden is to blame for this. We could say, well, the person who sold me this car is to blame for this because he sold me this gas guzzler. He convinced me to buy it. And now I'm having to spend more money on gasoline. And, well, my parents are to blame for this because they didn't show me how to be a good steward of my money. And we could just go on and on and on. And you know what? There's probably an element of truth in all of that. In other words, this web of social interaction that I was talking about makes it so that we kind of collectively share in some problems. So perhaps not often is just one person, even the direct perpetrator, to blame for sin. Many others frequently share the blame, either partially or indirectly, for sin and its problems. For example, bad parents can be partially responsible for their children's crimes. There's an element of truth in that. So because that is the case, this is the nature of life that we kind of, to a certain extent, share blame for our problems or our mistakes with others, then it's so easy to push that blame even completely off ourselves onto others. So if it's really the case then that blame for adversity or problems that result from mistakes that we made can be spread around like that, why then is it wrong for a person to blame others for his failures and problems? Well, let me mention five reasons why it's still wrong to just reflexively try to shift the blame for our mistakes and our problems that result from them to others. And the first of these reasons is that it's simply a lie. Shifting blame to others implies that we're not at fault for what happens to us or for the wrongs that we've done, or that others are just as responsible as we are. That's simply not true. To put blame on others as if to say that they share it equally is misrepresentative. Now, it is true that others might influence a sinner into wrongdoing, but others cannot force us to sin. We can choose to sin, and we do choose to sin. Even though we might be influenced and encouraged to do what is wrong, we can say no to that. So in that sense, we have to bear the responsibility for the wrong things that we do. It ultimately comes back to us, even though we may try to shift the blame to others. By the way, I'm not getting into a lot of scriptures at this point because the examples that we're going to look at shortly of people in the Bible shifting the blame to others, I think is going to illustrate the truthfulness of the points that I'm trying to make. So, blaming others does nothing to diminish our own guilt for our wrongdoings. That's a lie. When we try to say that others are in effect just as responsible for our wrongdoings and the problems that ensue from those wrongdoings as we ourselves are. But second, it's unfair. It's unjust. And that's because it relieves the one who is really guilty of wrongdoing at the expense of the people who are innocent, who didn't do that wrong. And all this is especially true because it's impossible to judge who besides the perpetrator himself is responsible for the wrongdoing. I mean, if a person commits a crime, who are you going to put in jail along with him? You're going to put his parents in jail? His friends? School teachers? Because they didn't do more to teach him not to commit that crime? So who are you going to say is really responsible for that crime, along with the perpetrator himself? And beyond that, then you've got to say, well, what percentage of the responsibility are we going to ascribe to these other people who share in his guilt because perhaps they didn't teach him or encourage him or influence him not to do that wrong? If parents are to be held liable for their children's misdeeds, as I said, why not their school teachers then? What about their friends? What about someone who was not so nice to them? And you could go on and on. So that this would give the criminal power to accuse anyone, just any number of people, any variety of people, regardless of their innocence. So that's why I say, secondly, blaming others is really unfair. It's unjust. But it's also, similarly, selfish. It reflects indifference to the pain of the innocent who did nothing to deserve it. It means that the perpetrator wants to escape blame, even if it means others may suffer for what he does. And if he does not care about that, that makes him a selfish person. Fourth, it's irrational. It can be a form of what psychologists call displaced anger, or what I sometimes think of as the kick the dog syndrome. Man's had a bad day at work. He wants to vent his anger. So he comes home and kicks the poor family dog. Under that circumstance, almost anyone becomes a target simply by virtue of being present or being available to be made the target. Some lash out in blaming others because they have to vent their anger and they can't take their anger out on themselves. They don't want to do that. That would be self-destructive. So they take it out on someone else who is completely innocent. Reminds me of people who go into crowded areas, such as schools, and just start shooting people arbitrarily and killing them in some instances. They've had a bad childhood. They're angry at people. They're angry at the world. So for that, they're going to kill people that they don't even know, who have no part whatsoever in their sufferings. It's irrational. They're blaming others for nothing. Finally, blaming others is wrong because it's harmful. It's harmful to the person who casts the blame. Why do I say that? Because of this. For a person to blame others for his own mistakes prevents him from taking responsibility for those mistakes and really for his own life and doing what he needs to do to succeed in life. We're not going to be able to succeed in life if we keep blaming others for what we do and the sufferings that result from what we do. I understand the impetus to blame others, and as I said, in some cases, yes, indirectly, others have to share in that responsibility because of their bad influence, for instance. But ultimately, the choice remains ours to do what we do. And as long as we see others as the ones who are responsible for what happens to us, as long as we blame others for our sufferings that have resulted from the choices and the judgments that we've made, then we're going to fail to assume the burden of responsibility. And we're not going to be able to change our life. Blaming others, you see, just camouflages our problems and discourages us from making self-correction. Perpetrators hurt themselves more than others when they act like they are the victims of others. Because we can't make progress in life, and we can't be happy by blaming others instead of doing what we need to do to take control of our lives, make better choices and judgments, and change ourselves. I realize that sometimes, yes, others hurt us, but they're not going to be able to hold us down forever. If we just keep trying to do what is right and live responsibly, yes, there are going to be some setbacks, perhaps as a result of others mistreating us. But if we refuse to let others decide what we're going to be and what our lives are going to be, and instead keep doing the right thing, eventually we succeed in life. All right, let's consider those who blamed others then. First of all, let's start off with first man, Adam, first human being. As a matter of fact, we'll read verse 13 along with verse 12 of Genesis 3 because we're going to consider Eve along with Adam. They both blamed others for their failures. So when they were confronted by God, let's see how they respond. First with Adam in Genesis 3 verse 12. And the man said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me from the tree and I ate." Then the Lord said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" And the woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." Okay. Let's think about Adam and Eve along those lines for a moment. So we see when God confronted Adam about his sin, eating the forbidden fruit, he tried to shift responsibility for his sin to Eve, and then by implication, it seems, to God. So that Adam was saying that his guilt was reduced, if not completely erased, since he would not have eaten of the forbidden fruit had Eve not given it to him. And furthermore, he was implying that Eve would not have given it to him if God had not created her and given her to him as a wife, thus implying that the ultimate cause of his sin was God. Well, all of this is untrue in the sense that 1 Timothy 2 verse 14 says, Adam was not deceived. And he had the ability, moreover, he had the obligation to say to Eve, "No, we cannot eat that fruit, and I particularly will not eat that fruit, because God said, you shall not eat that fruit, for in the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." He didn't do that. Therefore, the responsibility stays with Adam. And then we read from Genesis 3:13 about God's confronting Eve and her response. She said, "Well, the serpent deceived me, and I ate." So Eve tried to relieve herself of responsibility for her sin by saying that she had sinned because the serpent or Satan had deceived her. And perhaps she implies that it was God's fault for allowing Satan access to her. If God had not allowed Satan access to her, then she would not have been tempted by Satan. She would not have eaten the fruit. So there you have it. In any event, she implies that she was less guilty because she was deceived. And yes, 1 Timothy 2 verse 14 says, "The woman being quite deceived fell into transgression." Well, though Eve was correct in blaming Satan for deceiving her, since all sin is traceable ultimately to Satan, the fact that she was deceived did not relieve her of responsibility for her sins. Why is that? Because neither Eve nor anyone else has to be deceived. She was free not to believe Satan. And indeed, she had the responsibility not to allow herself to be deceived. She sinned because she chose to believe Satan rather than God, because she was fully aware of God's commandment. She repeated God's commandment back in verses 2 and 3 of Genesis 3. And here's something else that we need to bear in mind. Eve was not deceived into thinking that it was right to eat the fruit. She was deceived, all right. But in what did her deception consist? Was she deceived into thinking that God had changed his mind? No, it was all right to eat the fruit that he said they could not eat, and that if they did eat, they would die in that very day? No. Rather, she was deceived into thinking that eating the forbidden fruit would do something for her which it actually did not do. She wanted to be wise like God. She wanted to have the other benefits of the fruit, pleasant to the eyes, good to the taste, good as food. She allowed herself to be deceived about those things. But one thing she was not deceived about was that it was all of a sudden right now, on the basis of what Satan had told her, for her to eat that forbidden fruit and that it would be all right with God. She wasn't deceived about that. However, the very important point is that regardless of whether eating the fruit would have done what Eve wanted it to do for her, it was still wrong for her to eat it. Why is that? Because this was something God had forbidden. She knew that. Folks, let me tell you this. About that in particular, Eve was not deceived. Let's go to the next example, that of Esau. In Genesis 27, verse 36, we have this statement about the relationship between the attitude of Esau toward Jacob, his brother, after what Jacob had done to him. This is Genesis 27, verse 36. Then he, that is Esau, said, "Is he, that is Jacob, not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing." That's almost the complete verse. It's the part that is relevant to us, or my point. So what do we see here? Well, in all of Genesis 27, we see that Jacob deceived Isaac, their father, into giving him the paternal blessing that was supposed to be given, at least from Isaac's standpoint, to Esau instead. So Esau blamed his brother Jacob for taking away his birthright and the paternal blessing which went with it. And according to verse 41, he even threatened to kill him eventually. Well, what do you think about it? Jacob did deceive their father Isaac into giving him the blessing instead. So isn't Esau justified? Well, no. You have to read the background to this conflict, which goes back to the end of chapter 25 of Genesis. There we see that Esau later overlooked the fact that it was he who despised his birthright and had shown that he despised it by selling it to Jacob for a mere meal of stew. And anyone who had the kind of character which allowed him to show such low regard for his birthright and its privileges should not have had it, because he was showing that he was not capable of the kind of character necessary to appreciate what he had and to exercise its privileges and obligations. Esau was indeed an irreverent man, we're told in Hebrews 12, verses 16 and 17. There he is called a profane man, an immoral man, a fornicator. And this goes to his character, for he not only sold an important status, his birthright, for a single meal, but had also committed fornication by taking three wives. That was the character of Esau. But you see, he doesn't want to look at his problems, at his character that brought this on. He wants to put all of the blame squarely upon Jacob. Next, let's look at the example of Simeon and Levi, two sons of Jacob. In Genesis 34, verse 31, we see their response to their father, Jacob, after Jacob confronted Simeon and Levi for killing Shechem and his fellow citizens. They thought they were justified in doing this because Shechem had sexually defiled their sister. So this is the way in chapter 34, verse 31, that they respond to their father Jacob about this. They simply say this, should he, that is Shechem, should he treat our sister as a harlot? Jacob saying, look what you've done. You've created this terrible situation by killing a city full of people, the men in it. And now we're odious to all the people around us. Look what you've done. And they're basically saying, well, we were justified in doing that because he treated our sister as a harlot. So they're shifting the blame for what they've done. Because whatever Shechem had done to their sister did not excuse Simeon and Levi killing all of the Shechemites and then taking their wives and their children and their livestock, especially after they had made a covenant of peace with them. And they broke their word in a terrible way. In other words, they vastly, vastly overreacted and wound up killing innocent people with whom they had made an agreement. And when confronted about it, they shifted responsibility for this atrocity to someone else, Shechem, and what he had done. And there's the example of another son of Jacob, as a matter of fact, his firstborn, Reuben. And there's a bit of a background about his statement in Genesis 42, verse 22. That occurs in a context later on when they're next to the youngest brother, Joseph, after having been sold down into Egypt as a slave, had actually risen to become second ruler in the land of Egypt. And they, not recognizing him, wanted later on to buy food from him, having come down from their homeland in Canaan for that very purpose. And he took their brother, arrested him. And their minds go all the way back to what they had done before in selling Joseph into slavery. And how does Reuben react to all of this? It says in Genesis 42, verse 22, and Reuben answered them, saying, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. We're in trouble because of what you did. Now, again, here's a situation where, yes, there's enough blame to be spread around. But is Reuben completely innocent? Does he not have to shoulder his share of the blame? Well, he doesn't sound like it here. He says, I told you don't sin against the boy. This is all your fault. Well, what was the background for this? Well, Joseph's brothers had gotten to the point where they hated him. So much so that when they were away from their father, in a situation where he had come looking for them, they grabbed him. Reuben said, don't kill him. So they threw him in a pit. And then apparently Reuben was away for a while. And while he was away, they got Joseph out of the pit and sold him to some Midianites who were passing by, who in turn sold him as a slave into Egypt. That's the background for this. Yes, Reuben was away when they sold him. However, was he completely innocent? No. That's because he was the oldest brother. He was really the one on the scene who had the authority to say what was going to be done. And when Joseph showed up on the scene, Reuben, as the oldest brother, and the one in authority over the others, therefore should have said, we're not going to do anything to him. It was his duty as the oldest brother to prevent them from abusing Joseph, their brother, at all. But he didn't do that. He didn't step up to his responsibility. And for that, he bears the blame, or at least his rightful portion of it. Let's go to the example of Aaron. In Exodus, the 32nd chapter, the Israelites at the foot of Mount Sinai became impatient because Moses had been gone for 40 days, I believe. And they said, well, we don't know what has happened to him. So they went to Aaron, his brother, and said, make us a golden calf. So he said, give me your gold jewelry. And he made a golden calf from it. Then Moses came down from the mountain and confronted Aaron about this. So let's look in Exodus 32, beginning with verse 22, and see how Aaron makes an attempt to defend himself. Beginning with verse 22 of Exodus 32. And Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself, that they are prone to evil. For they said to me, 'Make a God for us who will go before us.' For this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And I said to them, 'Whoever has any gold, let them tear it off.' So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Likely story, isn't it? But you see, Aaron blamed two other parties for his sin. First of all, he blamed the people for pressuring him into making the golden calf. And he even gave more force to his claim by saying to Moses that even Moses knew how inclined to evil the people were. Yes, and Moses had been very exasperated by the people. And second, he blamed God. How did he blame God? Well, because he said he took the gold of the people, threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. Of course, he lied to Moses because that would have been a miracle of God, and that's not the way it happened. But still, since this would have been a miracle, Aaron was effectively claiming that God had actually been responsible for the golden calf and thus approved of it. So he's shifting the blame to the people and then ultimately to God. And yet Aaron did not have to yield to the people's voice. Again, he was the leader on the spot. He had them the responsibility to dissuade them from their sin. To say, "No, idolatry is wrong. We've already been commanded not to do that." He had that responsibility. And yet, instead of shouldering that responsibility and telling the people no, instead, he actually assisted them in their sin. Let's go next to the example of Samson. Samson really wanted to marry this Philistine woman. And he had, I guess, what we might call today something of a bachelor party before he married her. And he propounded a riddle to some of her people, his fellow celebrants. And they made an agreement. If you get the riddle right, then I'll have to give you a present. If you don't get the riddle right, then you have to give me a present. Well, they got together with his wife and really pressured her to get Samson to reveal to her so she could reveal to them then the solution to the riddle, which they did provide to Samson. Samson, of course, was upset about that. This is the way he puts it in Judges, the 14th chapter, verse 18. An interesting way to put it. It says about midway through verse 18, these are the words of Samson. "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle." His heifer, a female cow, referring to his wife. I guess he was kind of upset at it. So, Samson blamed his friends for using his wife to resolve the riddle. And yes, they did share some of that blame. They cheated. However, Samson's history with women exposes his weakness with them. When he wanted to be quite stubborn about things and insist upon his own way, he could do that because he did that with his parents. Back in verses 1 through 3 of the chapter, and said, "I want this woman as my wife." And he wouldn't have it any other way. So he was capable of being very strong with others when he wanted to be. But when it came to women, he was like, well, he was like jello in their hands. And also, he could have anticipated that his wife, whom he hardly knew, and who was a Philistine, might not be fully trustworthy and might reveal his secret to her people, which is exactly what happened. Now, you would think Samson would learn from this, but he did not. He forgot the lesson of this episode, and he ultimately died because he revealed the secret of his strength to, lo and behold, another Philistine woman. Strong man, but could also be a very stupid man. Then there's the example of King Saul. He was told in 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, to go and destroy all of the Amalekites and their livestock, and instead he spared their king, Agag, and the best of their livestock, supposedly for sacrifice. So then in 1 Samuel 15, verse 15, when he is confronted about his disobedience by the prophet Samuel, this is how he excuses himself. They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we have utterly destroyed. And repeatedly he keeps going back to the people. So, what do we have here? King Saul also excused his disobedience in not destroying all the Amalekites and their livestock by repeatedly claiming that it was due to what the people wanted. We're seeing a pattern here in leaders. Because Saul was the king, and as the king, he had the authority and actually had the obligation to act as a proper leader and refused to do what the people wanted because it was wrong. It was contrary to what God had commanded. He should have instead required them to act obediently. Saul and the people also seem to have had ulterior motives in sparing King Agag and the livestock. King Agag would be like a trophy of war to enhance Saul's prestige. And the sacrifices could be viewed by the people and used by the people as spoils of war. Saul was to be blamed. He had shown himself to be quite capable of overriding the people's desires in chapter 14, if that's what he wanted to do. But on this occasion, apparently, it's not what he wanted to do. So he allowed the people to have their way, apparently, and his way, too, in disobedience to God. Then there's the example of King Ahab. When King Ahab led the nation of Israel into the worship of the false god Baal, and the prophet Elijah, as a result, prayed that it would not rain, then Ahab blamed Elijah as the troubler of Israel for the famine which followed. Let's read 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 17 and 18. When they met, here's what happened. And it came about when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said to him, "Is this you, you troubler of Israel?" And he said, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's household have, because you have forsaken the command of the Lord, and you have followed the Baals." Oh, he calls Elijah a troubler of Israel because this famine had come about. So in response, Elijah points out to him, really the blame lies with you for this famine. You're the real troubler of Israel because Ahab had introduced the false religion of Baal into Israel. One last example, that of the one talent slave in Jesus' parable in Matthew, the 25th chapter. You may well know the story, how a master about to go off on a journey entrusted the three of his slaves varying amounts of money with the expectation that they would use that money to make more money. Well, the first two did, but not the last one who had been given one talent. When he was confronted about the fact that he had gained no more money for his master, he started to make excuses and actually had the temerity to shift the blame for his laziness, his inactivity, to his master. So let's look in chapter 25, beginning with verse 24. Matthew chapter 25, verse 24. And the one also who had received the one talent came up and said, "Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours." Of course, the master didn't accept his excuse. But what we see here is that this slave tried to shift the blame to his master for his failure to gain more money by observing that his master was so hard. He was a hard man. He was a demanding, insistent man, overly so. And he had made this poor slave so afraid of him that this slave was crippled by fear and he could do nothing. However, his excuse was also a failure. Why do I say that? Because think about the other two slaves. They didn't make that excuse. The other two slaves did not allow any fear of their master to keep them from doubling their money. And moreover, the master rejected what the slave said. He called him a wicked, lazy slave. He exposed him for what he was, so that the slave's effort to shift the blame to his master for his wicked, lazy character showed him to be wicked. showed him to be lazy. We need to bear in mind that fear of failing is not an excuse for not even trying. Because if we don't even try, we ensure our failure. So in conclusion, each person ultimately makes his own life what it is. I'm not denying that your life may not be all that it could be because of the interference of others. I do not deny that others have an impact upon you. Sometimes they may mistreat you because of nothing you've done. But ultimately, your life is under your control. And when someone mistreats you or tempts you, it is then your decision as to how you're going to react to that and what you're going to do about that situation. That's your responsibility. You know, there's an old saying I think that captures what I've been trying to say. It's this: fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Why is that? Because once you know you've got some bad friends who are influencing you badly, then it becomes your responsibility to say, I need a new set of friends, for example. Because faults will catch up with a person, and they may catch up with him when it's too late then for him to take responsibility. In Psalm 32, verse 6, this is impressed upon us in these words, Psalm 32, verse 6. There it says, therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they shall not reach him. Let's start taking responsibility for our lives and our decisions, our choices, our judgments while we can make some changes. Quit trying to shift the responsibility to others and assume control for our lives at a time when we can. Each one has to recognize the part that he plays in his wrongdoing or what has happened in his life. And when he finds out what that is, he needs to correct it. It may be that there's at least one person here today who has, perhaps because of spending too much time shifting blame to others, refused to take blame for himself or herself. If you're one of those people and you recognize that's not the right way to live life, and you want to start doing what's right, assuming control of your life in that sense, we would encourage you to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Come forward in faith and repentance, confess before us your faith in Christ, and be immersed, baptized in a body of water for the forgiveness of your sins, as the Scriptures command. If you've done that, but since then have fallen away, perhaps again started blaming others, or in some other way have become unfaithful, and you wish today to put things right with God and His people once again by a confession of your sins, we bid you also to come forward. Let your needs be known. As together for your encouragement, we now stand and sing.